Welcome to Wrap'em Focus, a podcast devoted to exploring the provocative and impactful aspects of the research published in regional anesthesia and pain medicine. Here, we'll make sure to discuss and debate the findings that matter most for clinicians, patients, and policymakers. I'm Brian Seitz, Editor-in-Chief. I am an anesthesiologist and professor at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. At Wrap'em, we believe well-done pain medicine improves health and well-being. I'll work to keep the discussion relevant and factual. Thanks for joining us. Let's get started. The COVID pandemic has impacted everyone. The world has clearly changed. Everyone has their own story and memories about the past several years. The good news from an epidemiological perspective is that scientists and clinicians have learned so much about the virus, its prevention, and treatments. During the height of the pandemic, the United States was already battling another crisis. So many Americans were addicted to opioids. Opioid use disorder, to put it formally, is a condition that likely impacts millions of Americans, with approximately 50,000 overdose deaths each year. Given that the COVID pandemic created an environment of high stress and anxiety for the majority of the world, it is very possible that this influenced patients with opioid-related conditions. Today, we're joined by Dr. Siddhartha Simha and Dr. Mark Bickett, who performed a systematic review examining the impact of the COVID-19 time period on opioid-related outcomes. Sid is a third-year anesthesiology resident at Michigan Medicine in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Originally from Troy, Michigan, he obtained his medical degree from Oakland University William Beaumont School of Medicine. Dr. Simha has a strong interest in acute and chronic pain management and research, with plans to pursue a clinical fellowship in pain medicine. Dr. Mark Bickett is the co-director of the Opioid Prescribing Engagement Network and assistant professor at the University of Michigan Medical School, with a joint appointment in the School of Public Health. A clinician scientist and practicing physician anesthesiologist, his work has been supported by NIH, SAMHSA, and the Foundation for Anesthesia Education and Research, and the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, otherwise known as PCORI. So thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thanks, Brian. Very excited to be here today, chat with you guys regarding our research. Should be fun.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be here with you and everybody listening in today.
In their systematic review, they examined 20 studies containing outcomes relevant to patients with opioid use, misuse, and opioid use disorder by comparing the period before versus after COVID-19 onset in the United States and Canada. So to start things off, can you guys tell us, how you got the idea for the investigation? I know that University of Michigan is a center of excellence with respect to opioid-related research, but I'm kind of curious to know if there was any internal data or either one of you had personal experiences that led you to think that the population of patients was more vulnerable in a pandemic setting.
Yeah, so growing up, my focus through medical school has always been trying to find a specialty that really focuses on pain, both chronic and acute. And that initially drew me to anesthesia as a specialty and then ultimately pain management. When I started medical school and residency, actually, it was right around the time of COVID-19. So March 2020 was when this all kind of took over. And then I started residency in July, and seeing this global outbreak of COVID, this drew me to kind of see how this intersects with other public health emergencies and also just vulnerable public populations as a whole.
Yeah, Sid and I were working in the pain clinic. It's a great pleasure to be able to rotate with the residents through there. And I mentioned to him about a study that had showed rates of drug tests for opioids that looked a lot higher in the months right after COVID compared to before. Now, this was like a pretty quick study. It was a research letter that was out there, you know, getting the results out pretty quickly. And we knew from speaking with patients in the clinic at the time, a few in person, but this was, you know, almost all video visits about the challenges of COVID and access to care.
Yeah, no, and it kind of makes sense kind of biologically. I mean, we know that lockdowns and the stress associated with that environment induced a lot of depression and mental health challenges in so many Americans, particularly the youth. And so it kind of makes biological sense that possibly that would interact with the use of various substances. So I think it's a super interesting question. And I know this is just a little off tangent, but in terms of kind of the practical aspects of taking care of patients with opiate use disorder, let's say an illicit use that that we often interact with those patients in the clinical area, did they have a hard time getting those medications at all during the pandemic, or was the supply kind of unchanged even though everyone else was in lockdown? Could you still get your opioids?
Yeah, it's a good question and a really valid one. I think a lot of folks had trouble with access to care around the time, and you know, you kind of have two flavors of folks getting treatment for opioid use disorder. One group ends up primarily taking methadone, and they get that pretty much only provided through the opioid treatment programs out there, where you got to usually go check in every day, get your dose. There might be some take-home doses, but really only for the people who are on stable doses. That contrasts a little bit with what we can prescribe, buprenorphine. And at the time, you still had to have an X waiver to be able to do it, but the regulations have since been changed, which is probably for another podcast, a very interesting topic there. So it was without a doubt, you know, a tricky time for a lot of folks with accessing medications, including those with opioid use disorder. So,
and possibly the stress with the whole pandemic could actually probably push people to do things they wouldn't have done prior to that in terms of taking more or taking other medicines with it inappropriately that could have actually influenced some of the results that you found that we'll get to in just a second. Mm-hmm. Now, we get a lot of submissions around the topic of systematic reviews, and these, as you know very well, these are very difficult projects to pull off. They take a long time, and they take a lot of people with a lot of expertise. And we follow the PRISMA guidelines, and as you know, reading the instructions too, there's a lot of rules there. Do you have any advice to our listeners and potential young researchers in particular? Regarding the necessary kind of resources and teams that you have to put together to pull off a project like this?
This was actually my first systematic review. And when me and Dr. Pickett first discussed this back in October of 2020, I don't think I really understood how long the process of a systematic review really takes and how extensive it is. It's all very detailed, and like you go through a checklist essentially to make sure you have everything required for a systematic review. But overall, great experience, and I really gained a new set of skills to guide future research endeavors. So I'm very glad to be able to do a study like this.
Yeah, nobody thinks of clinical trials as being all that easy to do. And I think they all actually have a lot of similarities with systematic reviews. You know, they should really be thought of kind of in similar light to each other. Basically, both have sets of standards you got to follow. You know, we should register both before we start looking at outcomes. Both have reporting requirements that go into those. Sid, did you have some advice about like what people should think about?
Yeah, so if I had to give advice to the regional anesthesia pain medicine community, it's just start early. It takes a lot of time to complete all the steps in the process. Really outline the steps, be very, you know, systematic about it, for lack of a better term. For resources, I would start with definitely finding a great mentor to really help you through all the steps. I was super fortunate to find Dr. Bickett and really go through this with him. Other than that, PRISMA 2020 checklist was fantastic. It gives you a very like high level overview of all the high points. That was probably one of my favorite resources to use, just going through that checklist, make sure we've hit all those boxes.
Yeah, what Sid not telling you about is, you know, his hours spent sifting through the titles, the abstracts, making sure we're doing quality checks on the data that's been abstracted from the studies. It all starts with having a really relevant and topical question. I know at the time, it was, you know, we were more pressed to say, you know, what's the impact of COVID-19 on the patients that we're seeing and the issues that they're facing? You got to have a really compelling need for the review to exist, to motivate, to spend all this time and energy doing that. And then the methods really need to align with the standards in the field. And that's where the PRISMA comes in, and these other standards about rating studies for risk of bias and elements like that. So,
yeah, that's great. Those are all great points. We'll come back to that. And I do want to stress a couple things for the listeners, for our potential contributors as well. The math behind some of the analytic techniques to actually put together a systematic review into a meta-analysis is really complex. And I want to first applaud you both for not trying to force a meta-analysis when a meta-analysis was not appropriate. And I think most of our readers know that basically there's different levels of systematic reviews, and you can take a systematic review and do essentially an analytic approach where you combine the data to get estimates that kind of represent the sum of all of the information. And when you have lots of heterogeneity in patients and study designs and outcomes, you really can't do that. And one of the fatal flaws that we see a lot with our submissions is people try to force that and getting a composite measure that really is not valid. And I don't know if it was hard to kind of avoid the temptation to try to do that because everybody wants that one forest plot that has the summary metric. But we, as a journal, welcome just really well done systematic reviews that summarize the literature for the clinician, because you have done the hard work, and there's also less risk when you do that because you're probably not going to be violating any mathematical kind of concepts. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but I was super happy to see this come across to us just as a systematic review.
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, if you can't combine them, it's wonderful to have that summary measure, but as you're mentioning, so many times it may not be appropriate. And in this case, there's just so many differences out there. You were talking about the heterogeneity, and whether it's the outcome measurement, the actual units, the metric that was used for that outcome measurement, the time periods that were there, all these things that end up making differences can introduce bias. And you're right, you know, at the end of the day, it's not going to help anybody to have a measure that's just so off that it's meaningless in that sense. And so at least when it came to the results we'll talk about in a little bit, you know, we're looking at ranges of things. We're looking at aggregate values, but we're trying to conceptualize that and take inferences from that are appropriate without too much of bias that's there.
Now, in terms of systematic reviews, there's a kind of an acronym called PICO, and that stands for Patients, Interventions, Comparison, and Outcomes. And readers really should make sure they understand what the PICO is for a particular systematic review. And your investigation is a little bit different, as you didn't really have a comparison group. I guess time is kind of a comparison group, but it's a little less conventional. Can you just help the listeners understand the specific PICO from your perspective?
Yeah, our study was actually very difficult to narrow down into that traditional PICO format. It was more so because, like you mentioned, we didn't have a comparison group. It was more so an exposure of COVID-19.
Yeah, we were noticing many studies were comparing these time periods from before COVID or what happened basically right up to the lead of it, then to what happened in the months afterwards or to some series of months, you know, in the year after COVID.
So our population was essentially people with opioid use disorder or opioid use or individuals at risk of opioid use in the United States and Canada. And then our intervention essentially, or more appropriately, the exposure was the coronavirus pandemic. Our comparison or control was a time prior to COVID-19 versus after COVID-19 as a public health emergency. Usually that time lined up with around March 2020. And then outcomes were just those relevant to opioid use, misuse, and abuse.
Yeah. So in essence, this is a epidemiological, natural exposure type thing that is really the quote unquote intervention. So that can be a little bit tricky for people, but I agree 100%. That's the definition of that intervention. All right. Well, now the fun stuff. Let's summarize the key findings. I know you have a lot of stuff here, and there was an infographic, and I really do encourage the listeners to look at the infographic. It is phenomenal, and it really summarizes a lot of the key takeaways. But from your perspective, what do you think the key findings were?
So we went through over 600 studies, found 20 that met our inclusion criteria for the systematic review. And across these 20 studies, essentially three measures were identified that assessed the opioid crisis. One was emergency department service utilization, which means EMS calls and ED visits.
Those ED visits were largely related to overdose. So they could be where people actually died or just the act of overdose without it being fatal.
So both fatal and non-fatal. And then our second one was urine drug testing results. So essentially just urine drug positivity results for opioids. And then third was naloxone use.
I think, you know, we as in the anesthesiology community know naloxone really well as this like reversal agent for opioids. It certainly has a few different formulations where it's available to the public to help reverse these opioid overdose deaths that might happen in the community.
So for ED use, 13 studies looked into this. And in 11 out of 13 studies, they found increases. They found that service calls increased from 17% to 61%, just depending on the study. And then ED visits increased 42% to 122% compared to the pre-COVID-19 period.
So yeah, all in all, a lot of the studies for ED use, you know, most of them showing those increases. For urine drug testing, that was one of the other outcomes. All six studies that had outcomes reporting on this showed increases there across the board for all the opioid-related outcomes there. So fentanyl positivity rates went up, 34 to 138%. Heroin went up 12 to 62%. Oxycodone had one study that just was constant, but the other ones went up to 44%.
Were those findings unexpected? I mean, I know you had kind of a sense that something was going on that got you excited about doing the study, but the magnitude of that signal, did that catch you off guard at all, or did you kind of think that was what it was going to be?
Yeah, it was pretty consistent. I think the other interesting thing was that many of these urine drug testing studies in particular were comparing not just opioid metabolites, but other drugs of misuse that could be out there that weren't opioids. And surprisingly, I think to myself and Sid and I think others, we didn't really see that large jump in the non-opioid substances out there. A few of them might have had some, but the signal was not high as compared to the opioids, where just kind of across the board, it was up. So
I know you probably thought a lot about this, but do you have any sense of why?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of different things. I mean, it's a combination of lockdowns, loss of employment. You've got patients that are just afraid to go outside in fear of catching this viral illness. I mean, you have lockdowns just preventing people from receiving formal healthcare even. And then people just not leaving their home and non-essential businesses closing down. So a lot of different things, just high stress, challenging environments for patients.
And Brian, you probably remember this as well. I mean, that's affecting everybody, right? So just across the board, across all of the United States. And then, for this particular patient group that we're talking about, folks who may be susceptible to poor opioid outcomes, they're probably going to be, more vulnerable than the average person for reasons other than COVID. Maybe these are folks who don't have stable housing. Maybe they have more medical diagnoses. They're not in a setting where they get regular care. And so you take the challenge from COVID, you put it on top of this already tricky situation. It just adding on another layer of leading to these unfortunate or uncomfortable outcomes,
Now, in terms of the population, just to make sure I have this right, I mean, I think of two types of, maybe this is too artificial, but I think of two types of patients. There's the stably treated opioid use disorder patient that's getting prescribed methadone or buprenorphine, suboxone. And then there's the untreated that is likely using illicit. And I know there's kind of a crossover. You can have like a hybrid of those patients. But I assume that these emergency room visits are a composite of both types of patients. And I wonder, it would be, not that you can answer this, or maybe you have an opinion on it, was one of those two more vulnerable in this scenario, the stably treated person, or the one that was already illicitly using? Because ironically, I would think that the latter would be harder to get more opioids with the supply chain issues. I don't mean to make light of this, but you would think that with lockdowns but maybe the illicit market just flourished in this. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a bit of speculation, but I think we would imagine folks who were plugged into care or had a relationship with an existing organization or provider that could be a prescriber of buprenorphine, or it could be an opioid treatment program, or at least had that existing relationship. And really the tricky part was getting new people in the door. National statistics are something like 10 million individuals in the United States, misuse opioids at some point in time in the last year. And for folks who aren't, we know there's a huge treatment gap for opioid use disorder in general, right? It's only like 1 of 5 people actually end up getting plugged into treatment with medications who could otherwise do it. And so it's probably that initial group that we're discussing, who's probably going to be even more vulnerable than the groups who are already plugged into treatment. But, across the board, they're both getting stressed by this.
Gotcha. As well. So Sid, do you think that the group that the signal that you saw in these studies, do you think that they were more the untreated or the treated opioid use disorder patient?
Hard to say. I mean, for the EMS visits and ED visits, it's a combination of both. But for a lot of the urine drug testing ones, it was patients that were enrolled in opioid agonist treatment or other already established with care and getting opioids for stably, like we had discussed. So hard to say, but if I had to say myself, I would think that the patients that are using illicit drug use are more vulnerable to having worse outcomes in the pandemic. But again, hard to comment on.
But that shows you how complex this really is, because if we want to try to improve conditions in the setting of another pandemic, we really need to distill down into these subpopulations. But that's great stuff, and it's really interesting to think about potential causes. That's all super exciting stuff, and there's one annoying technical thing I do want to talk about with respect to systematic reviews that I think really is important for our listeners to understand, and that's details about the grade assessment tool that's very commonly used and you used in systematic reviews. And grade is we recommend it. I do encourage people to kind of look at our instructions on our website about systematic reviews and meta-analysis in general. And we recommend using grade, and it is a quality tool that assesses across outcomes rather than at the individual study level, which is what you typically do for risk of bias. And I was wondering if you could give the listeners just a brief, maybe like overview of your experience using the tool, because it actually takes a little bit of work, and it's not as simple as one may think.
Yeah, really good point here. And I have to say, it's exciting to be able to dig into this a little bit in the podcast, because you know, this isn't the normal stuff of the tabletop conversations in the pain clinic or other places as well. So thanks for that opportunity, Brian. You know, for people who need a little refresher, as Brian mentioned, you know, GRADE here is really a framework about how to approach the evidence and then turn it into clinically meaningful recommendations. And so, as mentioned, it's another framed look at it, not as individual studies, but what's the mass of evidence suggesting to us, and then what are the kind of caveats that go in with that? GRADE, you know, like most things in medicine, has, you know, an acronym behind it, talking about the grading of recommendations, assessment, development, and evaluations. It's a mouthful, thus we're going to call it GRADE after this. And based on how well the studies are done, we can rate the evidence that's available. We then go and assign it basically a certainty of how certain we are about that evidence. And the certainty ranges from very low, which isn't great, up to high, which is good. Very low, the true effect is probably really different than what the estimated effect that we're saying it is in our study. And then on the other hand, high, very good. So we have a really, really good amount of confidence that the true effect that's out there is really similar to the estimated effect that we're reporting in our review. And so it's really important, now that you know that there's kind of this grading from kind of low to high and what they kind of mean about, okay, it does what we report represent the truth or not, that there are some really specific reasons that we end up going to downgrade how certain we are about the evidence. And so those are things that lead to bias. You know, if there are bias in the studies, if there's imprecision, if the studies aren't that precise, if the studies don't directly measure what we're thinking is important, and if the studies aren't consistent, those are the main ones that then impact how this relationship with grading the evidence goes. And so in our study, you know, across the board, things were fairly low evidence. These weren't randomized control trials. These weren't, you know, these were indirect measures. I think we, you know, made that point both in the introduction and here, and that downgraded the level of evidence to say, look, we have to say this is less certain than we'd like it to be, but that's the truth, and that's how the effect estimates that we're reporting here are.
Now those are great points, and I want to stress that the grade methodology should be reproducible with different users in theory. So it applies specific metrics, but it's so funny because you're alluding to kind of like probability theory, and so much in medicine is about probability theory. What's the likelihood you're going to get COVID? What's the likelihood that OUD treatment's going to work, et cetera, et cetera. We're always working in probability theory. And I think of in statistics, it gets, you know, kind of scary sometimes when you start looking at different modeling and different you know, techniques, and you never quite really know where the truth is, because you actually want, I ultimately want the truth. And I remember the story when I was working with actually it was as a statistician that's at the University of Michigan, that's our statistical editor, and we were working on a project together. Matt Davis, he's an absolutely brilliant guy, and it was a regression model, and there was, I forget the details of it, but it was like there was a couple assumptions, and it was like a fixed versus random versus fixed effect model, and one way the p-value was, you know, significant, is less than 0.05, and the other wasn't. And so then Matt says to me, well, which one do you want to use? And I said, I don't know. I want the truth.
It's challenging, right? I mean, that's the thing. You know, if you take one element of your approach and it changes and that changes the results, you know, how robust are those conclusions there?
You know, exactly right. Exactly right. So the grade tries to, like, I guess, provide a little bit of objectivity in the kind of chaos of these synthesized reviews where you're trying to put all these papers together. So, well, thanks for that summary, and I hope Matt doesn't get any funny emails after So I wanted to go on to deal with one of my New Year's resolutions that I'm kind of violating when I ask you this next question. So I tend to be a glass half empty. It's one of my personality quirks, and but I'm trying to be like more like glass half full. But I asked.
Good. They say optimism is infectious, right?
That's right.
Train yourself to be positive thinking. So this is.
But here I frame this next question in a negative perspective, and I could have actually done it in a positive. But I'm going to go with the negative. So because I already wrote it down. But so many of our readers may think that it is impossible to conceive of a scenario where the anesthesiology community can actually move the needle to mitigate the negative impact of a pandemic on something like substance use in substance use disorders. Can you challenge my negativity and give us some hope?
Sure. I mean, I absolutely think the anesthesiology and pain management community can have a huge impact on this. There's definitely ways that we can reduce the impact of a pandemic, and not only the pandemic itself, but the measures taken to kind of curb the spread of the pandemic. We can reduce the impact of that on substance use disorder. One of the biggest things that came out of COVID, and one of the few positive aspects actually, was the rise of telehealth, expanding telehealth to work with patients who are afraid to leave their homes, who have chronic illnesses, fear of catching the viral illness. That can be crucial to helping reduce the impact of the pandemic and then other measures taken. You know, when you have all these like measures like stay-at-home orders, closing non-essential businesses, opening telehealth and expanding telehealth, it was one of the best things to come out of the pandemic. And I think one of those things that we just have to keep moving forward with.
We do come across patients who are at risk every day. In the pain clinic, you know, is obviously where Sid and I were having these initial conversations, but also in the perioperative setting. You know, I do acute pain, regional blocks, rotate on the pain service. We identify patients who are at risk both in the perioperative setting and elsewhere. And so taking a moment really to engage and educate them about the risk that comes with some of the therapies or some of the ways that maybe they're not using the therapies appropriately, offering support. It's clear substance use disorder is a chronic disease, and there are medications to help treat that, help get folks into long-term recovery. While we might not be everyone be addiction specialists or feel that comfort there, we certainly have a great deal of knowledge with the pharmacology of these medicines, and our community can help link these patients to the care they really need.
Those are all great points. And I don't want to like open up Pandora's box because I know this is such a political topic. But I will say this, I mean, I think it's worth discussing. We know that there were health implications for lockdowns. And I know that from a scientific perspective, the efficacy of the lockdowns is subject to debate, right? And so if we think that that some of the things that you're seeing in your study were actually a reflection of perhaps maybe mental health issues related to a lockdown and the isolation and the loneliness, let's say, this is speculative. One thing I suppose we could do as a medical community is ask tough questions about the appropriateness of doing that again in a similar setting.
Well, I think, you know, we mentioned some of the challenges that come with, you know, this idea. I think if you talk to, you know, infectious disease specialists, which I have to admit I'm not, the answer to, okay, we have a, you know, a vector spreading as it in a respiratory way is going to be, let's have a lockdown. And then, you know, along with the stress that we talked about, there was certainly job loss, loss of these social interactions and social isolation that came with it. And those are real entities, right, that have profound impacts on communities that are out there. And so it is a bit of a weighing of, you know, okay, one of the things, you know, I have an economist background as an undergraduate. And one of the things I always talked about was, okay, well, you know, what is going to be the relative cost to the benefit of this choice? And I think that's a discussion that as physicians we have every day, if you're in the pain clinic prescribing medicine, but in anesthesiology, you know, choosing a anesthetic course for a patient, of talking about that evaluation of risks and benefits. And right. Here, you know, we might have focused a bit and kind of had a little bit of tunnel vision and then realized, okay, look, there's another side to this that is coming up, and those certainly do need to be considered right in the future as these come back again.
Right. And at least ask the questions and try to understand implications of social policy from a overall outcomes perspective, not one specific.
I think we're outcome. Just starting to understand kind of the experience that we went through. Even with the initial studies, we can say, okay, look, there was stress, there was anxiety, but this long-term implication of what it does and these measures that it impacts our health, not just for opioid use disorder, but on a much global, a much broader scale, I think are just starting to be understood.
Great. Yeah, those are awesome points. Now, kind of in summary then, or in closing, it's, you know, obvious that more work needs to be done to connect the dots between opioid-related complications and public health emergencies. We've touched on this, the signal that you found, but we don't really know the ultimate causes, and certainly we don't really know the absolute mitigation strategies. Although, as Sid pointed out, there's a lot of optimism. But so what do you think the next best steps are?
I think one of the main motivations we did for this review was really identifying some of the markers for the opioid crisis, really to understand the events of big impacts like COVID. Who knows, as we were talking about before, when the next big event, whether it's going to be another COVID or something a little different, will happen in the future. And we certainly don't have a crystal ball right now to say, oh, what's it going to be? When's it going to happen? But because of the review that we did, I think we do have a clearer picture of measures that our clinics, our health systems, our states, our federal agencies can look at to track how these big events are going to impact the opioid crisis and then those whose lives are really touched by it.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite parts of this study was that there's no clear delineation of did COVID itself cause these exacerbations in opioid use, or did the measures we took to, you know, curb the spread of COVID, is that what exacerbated it? So that was very interesting. And then, you know, moving forward, we have these measures now that we've included in the study, and just building off of those, using those in the future for other public health emergencies as surrogate measures.
All right. Well, that's a great summary. And I got to say, this is definitely one of the more important population health levels discussions we've had on this podcast, and so I'm really appreciative of both of your expertise, and I want to thank Mark and Sid for joining us, and thank you to everyone who's listening in, and we'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to the Rapham Focus podcast. Original music and production are done by Dan Langa. More information can be found at www.danlanga.com. We hope you'll join us in the future for more discussions with authors published in the Rapham Journal, and you can visit us at www.rapham.org.